Welcome to another episode of This Catholic Life, conversations about life's ups and downs, big and small, how we deal with every situation imaginable, whatever life throws at us, but still manage to be sensible, practical, and joyful. Today's show is Make Disciples, an honest conversation about how we can transform a local parish or our community by becoming more effective disciples of Christ, conscious, integrated, and active disciples. I'm your host, Peter Holmes, and today I'm joined by Ryan Galliott, our resident geek and artist. Hello. Welcome, Ryan.
Thank you.
And our special guest, all the way from across the ocean, not visiting us especially for This Catholic Life, but in Australia for many things, including public speaking and obviously hoping to introduce this idea throughout Australia. This isn't the first time you've been here though, Sherry, is it?
No, this is my fifth trip, I think.
And it's taken us this long. I guess we weren't around last time you were here. Sorry, I should complete my introduction. This is Sherry Waddell from across in America. Welcome to This Catholic Life.
Well, it's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Excellent. Your website, or rather the book I think I got this bio from, says that you're an executive director of Catherine of Siena Institute. And I think you were co-founding that in 97. Sherry has developed resources and helps lead an international team who have worked directly with over 170,000 lay, religious and ordained Catholics in 600 plus parishes. And I think you were saying before that's more now, Sherry.
It is. I think it's closer to 1,000 now because so much is going on and we have so many people working with
us. It's hard to keep count when you're so busy. And therefore that makes the next figure obsolete, 195 dioceses and archdioceses on 5 continents. Sherry's book, Forming Intentional Disciples, was published in July 2012, and it's a bestseller. It has sold over 150,000 copies, some of which went to my students when I was teaching Catholic leadership, and we made it our textbook. When not hanging around airports, Sherry enjoys tending her high-altitude Tuscan garden in the Colorado Rockies. Welcome officially, Sherry.
Well, thank you for having me. It's great to be here.
Before we jump in, you can find all the details regarding this Catholic Life podcast on how to contact us on our website, thiscatholiclife.com.au. And if you'd like to support us, you can subscribe on your favorite podcasting app, or you can help us out by leaving a review on iTunes. Get in touch with us on Facebook or Twitter or any other of the social media options. It helps people discover our podcast more easily. Let's dive right into today's topic, making disciples. We should begin by defining what we're talking about here. So what do we mean by making disciples? Ryan, you've done a lot of this sort of evangelization stuff over the years. How would you define it?
Well, that's an interesting thing. I mean, one of the previous episodes, I believe we've spoken about the concept of evangelization. And oftentimes we have the problem of we think we're the ones that evangelize, and I think that's problematic. But I think for my experience, it's always been about helping others have that encounter with Christ. And so I think for me, I'd say that making disciples is just helping others in their relationships with Christ.
Okay.
Yeah.
Are you comfortable with that definition, or have you got another one to give us, Sherry?
Well, it would certainly encompass all that. I mean, one of the issues we're becoming aware of, and very dramatically, is many, many people, including lifelong Catholics, don't even know you can have a relationship with God. It comes like a stunning surprise to them. So, and some of them, we discover, think of God as sort of a distant, really nasty authority figure who just shows up to beat you up a little when you mess up, but doesn't really love you, doesn't care about you. They tell us they don't even know who Jesus was, and they were raised in the church, and they attend Mass every weekend, but they didn't know who he was. He was some kind of distant, he was a guy they heard of who must have done something good because people talked about him, but he wasn't God, because God was the cosmic taskmaster figure.
That's right.
And so it sounds easy, you know, to say, well, a disciple, I mean, you know, I say it's somebody who's chosen to follow Jesus as his disciple in the midst of his church. But of course, you have to unpack that,
right?
Because there's so many. That's the issue. Is people are starting so far back now, whether you're raised in the church or not, whether you have any religious background or not. And so some of the really basic stuff, like, is there a God, a personal God at all? And if so, do I want to get anywhere near that God? Is a whole nother.
Getting near God is kind of a scary thing if I don't have a relationship with him.
That's right.
Martin Luther, way back, was talking about the difference between the idea of what he called Deus absconditus, which means a God that's absent from me and far away. It's almost less scary than a God who's right up in complete in my face. And,
well, yes, but are they in your face as someone who's going to slap you around?
Yes.
I mean, or I mean, is that what you think that that authority, that divine authority figure is? It's not a God of love. And why would you want them in your life if it's not?
Well, I mean, that's just it. If we don't have that relationship, I mean, that relationship is what colors how we live our faith, how it is that we interact with other people and how we allow it to really come out in all the walks of life that, you know, that we participate in. So
yeah, but for so many, because we've listened, because of the nature of our work, we've had a chance to listen to tens of thousands of Catholics all over the world just talk to us in very personal terms about their living relationship with God, their experience of God. And, you know, we can't assume anything. If they say they're Catholic, you have no idea what that means, really. It could, they could be functioning agnostics, atheists, or absolute nuns with a religious identity that they still hold on to.
Can we just pause there for a sec? The nuns there, you mean people who say they are no religion?
People who say they're no religion, N-O-N-E.
Right.
Yep. Right. So I'm a nothing. What are you? Yep. Well, I'm nothing. Okay. Yep. I don't have any faith or any religion.
There was a kind of a pun recently in a social media thing where someone said, the problem is that some of the nuns are nuns.
Yeah. That's possible too sometimes. But
it seems like what you, I mean, from what we were saying earlier, the question to that you've been asking Catholics are questions they haven't come across before. Can we unpack that? You talked about how many people you've spoken to.
The big question we ask them is, first of all, you have to earn the trust level to even ask this, because this is very personal. Yeah. So, but if you have a friendship and there's some reasonable level of trust there, what we tend to ask people is just, you know, I'd love to hear your story of your experience of God, your journey with God, whatever language seems appropriate with that person, you know, so far. And then
kind
a
of
lot
a
of
what
times,
brought you here sort of question.
Well, not even a what brought you here, depends on where you are already.
Okay, yep.
But we're presuming you're there with them for some other reason. And maybe it just seems, or I've even done this with total strangers on airplanes, you know, but I spend an hour building a relationship of trust and then.
Or if you're on the flight to Australia, 14 hours.
Yes, 14 hours. And then, you know, literally, you know, I was prompted, ask him the question. I said, okay, this is going to be really interesting. So where is God in all this for you? You know, boom, you know, they never stopped talking for 2.5 hours.
Yeah.
People don't mind talking about themselves, though. They don't, as long as you're not imposing something on them and they're just allowed to talk, they don't usually mind.
It's one of the most powerful things, and this is studies that have been done about Australia. Australians are most likely to feel free to talk about faith, to be drawn to talk about faith or religion or metaphysics or whatever by having conversations with people. And the kind of conversations, though, that we need to be having are, A, they don't feel judged, and B, we're not controlling the outcome. In other words, they feel free to draw their own conclusions.
Express.
But our job is to ask the leading question, the intriguing question that opens up more doors.
Yep.
We've seen people move spiritually just by talking to someone who honestly just tries to listen. They're not fixing them, not correcting them, they're not catechizing them. They're just trying to understand from that person's perspective what it was like to live this experience of God.
Yeah.
And to really understand it as deeply as you can, but to be listened to have somebody ask and to have somebody really listen.
Yeah. That's a big skill, isn't it?
Changes everything.
It's a skill we don't seem to have developed very well in our modern society. It's very rare to find someone who's a good listener, because it takes them caring enough about the other person to invest the time to try and understand, what does it mean for you?
That's right.
Not what I want to tell you.
Yes. We spend a lot of time, it's one of the primary skills we train people in, is how to listen to someone's story and recognize the significance of this, what they're trying to tell you in terms of their spiritual experience and development, in a way that means you could actually meet them where they are. You can honor what God has already done in their lives and what they've already experienced, whatever it was. And you can still say to them, there's more, but I can meet you where you are right now.
Yeah.
I'm not going to try and fix you.
That's right.
And the temptation is, I mean, maybe it's just for someone like myself, the temptation is to analyze their story and sort out what's, you know, that's valid, that's not. But it's actually not about my categories. It's not actually even about what I want to come out of it. If I believe this person is loved by God, then they're worthy that they demand my love, and therefore that means investing the time to understand mm-hmm. their story. Mm-hmm. And also, when you listen to someone, you learn their language. I mean, if someone tells you nonstop about sport for 3 hours, you go, okay, well, there's a bunch of analogies I can use. that right. I can actually talk to them with, because yes. clearly using some other thing like out of politics isn't going to appeal to them as much.
No. But most of it's really interesting. Most people tell us no one ever asked and no one ever listened.
Yes.
So it's a whole new experience for them, for somebody to take it seriously enough. And it does say, whatever their experience has been, it says that person thinks it's important enough to ask and to really listen to me. And we've seen people really grow spiritually just by telling their story.
I was just going to say that it's important as well to help them understand that their voice has a place in the relationship.
Mm-hmm.
Where they've been, where they're at.
The relationship with God?
Relationship with God.
Okay.
And it's not us to judge them on where they are, but to really help nurture that relationship by being loving ourselves.
Mm-hmm. And it sets up what's really interesting. They just had a new study that came out in Britain, and I was just there in June. And one of the things they found is if you can give somebody one positive experience of talking about faith, you have doubled their openness to doing this again.
Wow. Mm-hmm.
Most people who, if I have no positive experiences of talking about faith in a year, I am overwhelmingly unlikely to be open to this later.
Yeah.
I have one or more experience of positive conversations. It means my trust level goes way up, my defenses go way down. And I may never see this person again. You know, the person on the plane, I never saw again. But I'm like a little link in a chain. And maybe you're the person they know on an ongoing basis.
Right.
And I'm just there. My point is to have that conversation right then. Maybe to raise their level of trust and their willingness to talk about this subject again with you.
And also to get them thinking about it. Because if they have to talk to you about it, they actually have to actually make a coherent assessment of their own mind. Can I bring you back to the listening part? Because we can also, there is a possibility of us destroying the next opportunity by being bad listeners, or perhaps having, I think, Ryan, you mentioned in an earlier episode, the flirt to convert sort of thing. You're just pretending to be their friend in order to get them to a certain stage, and then the friendship becomes a fake, and that actually undermines anything that could have been said.
Yeah.
But
absolutely.
It's something even worse, and it's something, as you've already encountered in me, is that I have a tendency to overtalk things. And so if someone says to me, don't you guys worship Mary? I take a deep breath and I've got, you know, however many dogmas there are ready to come out. And that's actually profoundly dangerous in that situation. No matter how well-meaning or how good a listener I am, if I have taught them that asking me a question results in a 20-minute diatribe.
We really have to be careful. We can drown a tablespoon of spiritual curiosity with a gallon of answers to questions they don't even care about, may not even know exist. So we're, you know, if we're insiders and we're fascinated with all this stuff, but our job at that moment is to set all that aside. And I'm sorry, even if we have people tell me all kinds of things. I had one guy who, in a private conversation, basically described God as a vivisecting bastard.
Okay.
And I'm like, okay, whoa, you know, there's a lot of stuff under that. But what's my job? My job here is not to defend, but to say, wow, tell me more.
Yeah.
I'm an atheist. Really? Are you? That's fascinating. I'd love to hear more.
Yeah.
You know, and it is fascinating because we know that God's Holy Spirit is at work and in touch with every single human being we encounter, whether they have any religious background of any kind or not. That Holy Spirit has not left them without some kind of witness.
Yep.
So there is something there. And even if they're atheists, and when we teach people to do this, we bring in people who are not Catholic to tell their story. So we've got atheists and agnostics and Buddhists and all these people and lapsed Catholics, anybody but practicing Catholics. And, you know, and so their stories are all over the map.
Mm. Something you said just then about the temptation to try and defend God against the angry person is actually, it's in the Bible. It's one of the oldest books of the Bible is Job. And Job has a go at God. What's going on, God? Things are happening badly. And his friends, who start out to be really good friends who come to help and comfort him, end up progressively getting worse in their defense of God and mm-hmm. condemning him. And at the end of the book of Job, God comes out and says, you guys didn't get it right. Job got it right. Now, he's been ranting at me all this time, but he got it right. It wasn't just, it wasn't fair. And you guys have actually defamed me by defending me. Mm-hmm. So we can get ourselves in that trap of. Mm-hmm.
And this is not it's a special moment. You have to understand you're not in a normal conversation. What's interesting, of course, is when this conversation starts, you're already like you get together with a friend, you know, you're drinking coffee, beer or whatever. Mm. And all of a sudden you realize they've switched and they're starting to talk about this stuff. You have to understand you are in a Kairos moment. You're in this special moment where the rules are now different until they let you know the conversation's over. And so at that moment, your job is to be a man or woman for them and to give them the safety and the space. Mm. And your job is to just ask clarifying questions that kind of, if you're not certain what they're saying or trying to understand.
Also, one of the rules is that they have to be safe to walk away.
They have to be safe to walk away.
They have to be able to walk away at any time. Absolutely. And if we can't let them go, then we've taught them that it's not safe to raise this topic ever. Otherwise, they're going to get hunted.
This is not apologetics time.
No.
Even if they believe really insane things about the church. Mm. And I mean, one true story is the mother of a friend who, as a young woman growing up in the American South, ran into somebody who really thought Catholics had little horns in their heads. She was a beautician, and she kept looking for the horns. And she said, I think they're retractable or something. You know, they come. She says, where's the horns? You know, even if they think we have horns in our heads, we don't want to get distracted by that. You know, you're going to have to work hard to keep your face straight. But I mean, it's like, because what's behind it is what matters, right? Then at that person, they need whatever the fear or the anxiety or the longing, our job is to give them the space to, because this is like in counseling, they talk about the presenting problem, the thing I talk about first, but that may not be the real issue, right? Mm. But it's safe. I bring it up first because I feel a little bit safe about it.
And it also is a little bit of a test to how you handle this. Right. That gets you the next level.
That's right. But if we don't get sucked into that, don't react, but we realize my moment is to get them back as much as possible to that relationship with God and whatever the story is.
And an inch is a cinch and a yard is very hard.
Yeah. So, but we, you know, it is one of the most powerful, and it's beautiful for the person who listens. I mean, Catholics are stunned because they normally never have these conversations.
Even with themselves.
People don't even know what they have to say until somebody asks. They've never put this into language before.
It's interesting you say that, because one of the most fondest memories I have from studying at university is that for about a year or two, it became almost a weekly thing where once or twice a week, I'd spend 4 hours or so in the common room just discussing faith and belief with people of different faiths or even non-believers, atheists. Ah. And it was never a conflict. It was always questioning and why did we come to faith? And it was a real dialogue. Mm-hmm. And it was interesting to see how many Christians didn't even believe or understand what it was that they believed or had faith in.
Mm. Oh, yeah.
And so it was never a judgmental conversation. Mm. And I think a lot of people kept on coming back to that conversation specifically because it allowed them to express, and a lot of them realized what they wanted to learn more about their faith. And I found a lot of people around us were also listening intently.
Yes, indeed. Mm. They will be listening.
There's a power in stories, isn't there? There's a huge power in stories. And often I've been involved as an evangelical and as a Lutheran and as a Catholic now in different attempts at evangelization. Mm-hmm. And no matter what happens, it always, the most powerful part of that, not just the initial contact, but even us learning now are the stories. And even Christ, obviously the epitome of wisdom, used stories primarily in his, and this is why we go to saints too, the stories of the saints that draws us in. And it's interesting that in evangelization, the stories become a huge thing. But what you're pointing to here is a much deeper thing, that their story, when it's brought into light of God, actually it transforms their story.
Mm-hmm. And they actually, and again, you know, when we talk about these thresholds, these sort of stages that a lot of people in the 21st century in the West, kind of the journey we go through spiritually, it's trust is the first step. Mm. A lot of people don't have a bridge of trust of any kind regarding the church, Christianity, or even a Christian. Mm. So one of the first things, you know, that we learn is having an experience of these positive conversations where that is not judgmental and where I'm not controlled. I still am in control of my conclusions. That builds a bridge of trust. Yep. And in evangelization, really, that's the first task for not. It's interesting, not just for people who are obviously not Catholic or obviously not Christian, but even for people who come from Christian traditions but have many mixed feelings and maybe bad experiences and stuff.
Let's push this a little. We spoke before the podcast and also during the podcast so far, we've come across this idea that someone might be in the church and still not have encountered this question of their story with Christ. Yeah. And in particular, you ask in the book, what the personal relationship with Christ is. Can you expand on that perhaps a little bit more? Ask specifically in relation to asking, you know, people out there listening to this might have been in the Catholic Church, involved in the sacramental life of the church, but what's the question and how powerful it is?
Well, it's interesting because what we're discovering, and this is relatively new for us, again, many Catholics have separated God and Jesus, for one thing. They don't. And even people raised in the church have told me, and one woman came up to me about a year and a half ago at a conference and said, Jesus was my buddy when I was a kid, but he wasn't God. He could be my buddy because he wasn't God.
Right.
Because God is this other authority figure, the kind of hard-nosed taskmaster figure. Yep. And I can't tell you how many people I've had those conversations with. I learn now that after I asked them about kind of just describe to me or whatever your journey with God has been like, partway in, I say, and where's Jesus in this figure, in this story for you, in this journey? And about half of them, even the ones raised Catholic, said he wasn't there.
Right.
So when we talk about, you know, following Jesus as a disciple, obviously that means there's a whole, for a lot of people, there's a whole process of discovery from the very beginning. Can I trust this figure? That's why we talk about moving from trust into early curiosity. And eventually, and the goal is the goal is to make disciples, we want to foster curiosity about Jesus.
That's right.
Deliberately. Mm. So, of course, scripture could be one way, you know, reading the Gospels, hearing stories about Jesus, especially stories related to healing and forgiving sins, which raise the issue of personal change
and
get you in touch with your own desires for personal change and all that.
Mm.
And so for a lot of people, we can't presume any of this is being carried by the culture anymore, and not even by our families usually. Yeah.
Not in Australia, even less perhaps in Australia.
Yeah, not in Australia, but not in the Britain, not in the US by and large, not in Canada, not in New Zealand where I'm going. In none of these places, the majority of us, many people are starting from almost a kind of zero. They don't, not that they may not be hostile to the idea. They just have nothing to work with.
We used to have in one of our classes, we had a question we'd open up with. It was a scripture class. And so we'd say, tell us your favorite scripture story. And we had to stop doing that about 10 years ago because we had a room of 110 young people just out of high school, Catholic schools, most of them, not one story could any one of them name. And you say, okay, we're in a culture now that's utterly different. Now, that whether it doesn't matter what brought us here, what matters is this, we have to change our mind from being, let's assume that we're almost there and we just need a top up. We're literally in a mission field.
Yes, we are absolutely. We're in missiondom, not in Christendom anymore. Everywhere is a mission field. So you can't presume. Our motto is, never accept a label in place of a story.
Love that line in the book. Loved it.
And that's everyone, when we teach people how to have these conversations, we just say over and over again, the motto is, And it doesn't matter what they tell you originally, you always say, tell me what that means. If they say they're an atheist, you literally, that may not mean they literally don't believe in God. It's usually a personal statement of some kind.
Yeah.
They may mean, I don't believe in that God over there.
Yeah.
My mother's God, my brother's God, my whatever.
Or when I was in a hospital chaplaincy, it often meant, I did believe in God, but my child is suffering and I'm really angry with God, so I'm going to get back at him by not believing him.
Right. I mean, there's always a story under there.
Yeah.
And so that's fine. You just say, tell me more. You know, what does that mean? What do you mean by that?
It also dignifies the human being, which is a core sure. Christian understanding. And Christ himself exactly. spent time listening. And the woman at the well, he didn't, you know, grill her about her doctrinal
yeah.
things. And she clearly had a worship that didn't match the Jewish worship. And yet he listened to her story and entered into that story. So
we have to understand, even for Catholics, and even for Catholics who practice, who actually come to Mass on a regular basis, stunningly, and I can't tell you how many people have told me since Forming Intentional Disciples came out, and I have heard this from people in full-time ministry. I have heard this from archbishops, from seminary rectors, from priests, from religious, from lay leaders at all levels in a number of different countries. Basically, they would say, when I started ministry, when I was ordained, when I took my vows, whatever, I wasn't a disciple. I am now, and let me tell you my journey, but I wasn't then. Or I've, even more stunningly, is the number who come and say, I did not know it was possible to have a relationship with God.
Right.
We can't even presume they know that's possible.
Mm.
So,
which is remarkable, because it's the center of Scripture. The whole of the Scriptures is based around this idea that God is the husband.
No, and, you know, we're the wife. No scriptural awareness, no scriptural exposure,
yeah,
nothing. Can be presumed. So you and I are introducing maybe a wholly new idea for the first time in their life. And the only person, the reason they may not even be aware of it in the early stages, we're helping people become aware that this is actually an option. And the only reason they know is because you talk like you have one. Yeah. And they're going, that's weird.
You're not one of these hippies, are you?
He's really, I always knew he was weird, but he's really weird. But it's still kind of interesting,
Having come through a few different churches, my experience in trying to convince Catholics that a personal relationship with Christ is something worth pursuing, because I'm a scripture teacher, I come from the angle of, this is a conversation between you and God. Oh, what does it mean? Just give me the answers. No, it's a conversation. This is an ongoing relationship. You read scriptures and you pray scriptures because this is your conversation with your love, your first love, God. But Catholics, on the one hand, sometimes treat it like a catechism and something to be learned, and then you put the answers into the box kind of thing. But on the other hand, they're a little bit suspicious because they've heard, perhaps someone of my age has heard people talking about a personal relationship with Jesus as opposed to being Catholic, as opposed to the sacraments.
Me and Jesus without the church,
yeah,
basically.
So I'm not, it's kind of the old, I'm not religious, I'm spiritual thing.
Right.
But
right.
That's not what we're talking about here.
No. But though there's a significant number of people who say they're spiritual and not religious in Australia.
Oh, yes.
Studies bring that up. And actually, they're a little bit closer to us than, I mean, that's actually a bridge for a lot of people.
Sure.
So from a missional perspective, you think it that way. However, of course, I mean, we believe that in the Eucharist, I mean, the risen, glorified Jesus Christ is dwelling 24/7 in the hearts of all of our communities.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Right? In his humanity and his divinity.
And he's not just sitting there in a box.
No.
He's actually given for us.
Yes, he's given for us. He's not just passive. He's not, as Pope Benedict put it, a very holy thing. he is a person. He is a living, glorified Lord. And he's active. He's not just sitting there passively so we can stare at him. You know, and he's on our altars, he's in our tabernacle, he's in our adoration chapels. And of course, in the end, we receive him, and the goal is that he will be in our hearts. He is both living in the center of our community, and we are, of course, his body. There's so many images that the church talks about where we are the body of Christ, we are the bride of Christ, but at the same time, his saving presence, which was John Paul II's term, you know, is in the center of our communities 24/7, and not just for us as Catholics, but for every human being on the planet.
Yeah. Well, in the Old Testament, the tabernacle was the place where God was present in his mercy. He was present everywhere, of course, but present in mercy and forgiveness and love to them.
Yeah.
And when in John 1, when it talks about Christ becoming flesh, the Word became flesh and tabernacled amongst us. So in Christ is God's mercy and forgiveness and love. And where he comes to us, it's always in that mode. It's never the wagging the fingers kind of judgmental. Can we perhaps come back? You talked about thresholds, and we've touched on it several times now, but can we talk about the different thresholds that turn up in your book? The first one was trust.
Trust is the very early one, is people, there has to be, maybe I just trust you. I don't trust anything you believe.
Yeah.
I think that's all, that rubbish is all rubbish. But for some strange reason, I know you're a believer, and I like you and I trust you, and you may be my living bridge of trust. Mm. Now, we want to strengthen that trust and we want to broaden it.
Yeah.
But we have to find out, is there any bridge at all in place? And if not, guess who gets to build the bridge? That's us. That's the first task. And then as people, their trust becomes, you know, stronger and stronger. And I think we need to understand, Australian studies indicate there is a lot of Australians who do not consider themselves Christians, but who actually have bridges of trust in place.
Right.
About one quarter of the adult population in Australia actually falls into what they call the warm toward Christianity category.
Right. What was that stat again?
This is the study. It says it's faith and belief in Australia. It's 2017. It's really amazing from an evangelizing perspective. It asks all kinds of fascinating questions and uncovered this. So there's people who are neutral toward us. There's people who are cool or to the point of hostile.
Yep.
But there's a very significant number of Australians who actually say things like, well, I believe in Christianity, but I'm not a Christian.
Yeah.
Like.
That's often attached to an experience or a relationship with them too, because I've got a friend, I mean, one of the online gaming communities that I'm in has lots and lots of atheists and angry people against the church. But one friend came to me and said, I'm not Catholic in any way, but can you help me get hold of Father so-and-so? And I, hang on, who is that in a different city? Well, when I was homeless, he helped me out and found me a place to live. And that really mattered at the time. Nobody else has ever done anything good for me religious-wise, but I wanted to go to him specifically and say thanks.
Absolutely. And so that's very critical. And then we want to help them, though, become curious. And the art of raising curiosity in our setting is to ask questions, not to just unload, you know, a dump of doctrine or the catechism or whatever. That's my tendency, of course. I want to, you know, I'll take Thomas Aquinas and all this stuff, and I'll just, you know, drown them in all this stuff that I find so interesting. But that's not the goal. The goal is to do what Jesus did, because he hardly ever gave a straight answer to a straight question. He always did Q&Q, not Q&A. And so, we want to ask evocative questions that increase their wrestling, increase their curiosity. And especially, we want to do so in a way that they become curious about Jesus, because he is their bridge into the kingdom, right?
And yeah, so we're not.
Yeah. We're not. And not even, if you will, doctrine in the sort of the abstract sense is necessarily the bridge into the kingdom. Not for a lot of people now.
That's a clarification of the person. So if you have a relationship with someone, like when I first met my wife, I didn't go and look up her history and all her, you know, specifications and everything and say, those sorts of things happen to come across the table as we get further and further into the relationship.
Exactly. And so we want them to become curious and more curious about Jesus, which is where telling Jesus' story, exposing them to scripture and the gospels all becomes really important. And then the next stage that's super critical in our culture, and this is something we've just really become clear about in the last couple of years, this is going to seem, let me see if I can describe it. We've discovered that many very active Catholics, people who like attend Mass on a regular basis and maybe very active in their parishes or their diocese or something, sometimes they get stuck at early curiosity.
Right.
And they don't move beyond that. What we're discovering is for some Catholics, many cradle Catholics, the first direct encounter with God is moving from curiosity into the threshold of openness.
So then, now, just to recap, I'm doing a...
Let me explain. I was about to say
so we,
what
the, we have
the movement from into openness. Openness is about declaring yourself open just to the possibility of change. It's not a commitment. Mm-hmm. I'm not signing up for anything, but I'm acknowledging to God and to myself, maybe I'm just 1% open. I'm just going to open the door just a crack.
And it, could, it might not necessarily be openly, I'm curious about religion, but I'm open to this question. I'm prepared to ask you this question.
It's a sense that I'm open to God or to the divine. There is some kind of conscious acknowledgement of that to God. And for many Catholics, it's the first time they've ever attempted to speak to God personally.
Okay.
And we're discovering for many of them, because they were used to like relating to the church and the church related to God for them.
Right.
And this is the first time they've kind of moved beyond that. And they're actually, if you're there and if you care and if you're listening.
Yeah.
And I don't know if any of that's true.
It's a very vulnerable moment, isn't it?
It is. It's because we have to lower our defenses to do this. Right. So it's hugely vulnerable. It's a big transition for a lot of people. And so
not the time to give them my 17 leaflets from the, you know.
Probably not. No, I would not strongly recommend that. You want to, you know, we want to help people make that journey, but this is not a time to dump a bunch of doctrine on them.
And it doesn't help anyone really. So we've had so far, we have the initial trust, the openness,
the
curiosity, and then the third stage is threshold is openness. Where do we go from there?
And then as people become more and more open, and of course, we're presuming that if they were curious about Jesus, they're becoming open to Jesus, right? Because the process is continuing. Then they typically move into seeking. Well, seeking is not casual curiosity. Now, this is serious curiosity. Mm. This is like, you know, it's like dating seriously. Mm. You're starting to think, are you the one? Am I going to commit? Is this going to change my whole life?
And so some of the questions get really hard at this point.
Questions get really hard.
And they sound like they're being antagonistic sometimes at this stage.
The early thresholds tend to be passive. This is not passive.
Right. Yeah.
This is actively grappling with the possibility, again, and you haven't made a commitment, but the possibility that I might follow Jesus as his disciple. So this is where many people in our culture start to deal with personal sin for the very first time, which in most people in our culture, that doesn't even exist anymore. But it's interesting, you may not even have to raise the issue because the Holy Spirit often raises the issue for you as people move into this and they become aware for the first time that they've actually done some maybe seriously bad things that were actually hurt other people and they were responsible, they freely chose to do
and
it.
And themselves often.
Yeah, and themselves. And they start to, suddenly it dawns on them because of course, we've been walking with them, we want them to be grappling with, you know, more and more of what Jesus says and what he taught, you know, and stuff like that. And so at seeking, we're helping them grapple with, will I choose to follow him, begin the journey, the lifelong journey of intentional discipleship. Yeah. And one of the things we tend to not do very well at all as Catholics is create safe, clear, uncoerced opportunities for people to say yes.
I think one of the struggles in this stage that I've found, because we're in a state of history, I guess, where we have almost everything at our fingertips. And some people reach this curiosity stage and then this further more active searching and just rely on what they can find online or whatever. And at this stage, having someone who's able to be there affirming and not judgmental, but firm themselves in their own faith to be able to speak.
That's a very important point. People won't find Christ if they don't see it in the person who's there.
That's right. And the person who's with them. We have to model seeking after Christ in our own lives on an ongoing basis, even if we are disciples already. Mm. And, I mean, the whole vision of this, we form what we call Ananiases. Ananias was St. Paul's first mentor after his conversion, you know, after he saw Jesus on the street, you know, the road to Damascus, and he has this dramatic blinding experience. And the first Christian he meets is Ananias, who God sends to him.
Mm. And Ananias is sitting there going, seriously, God? Is this the same guy who's been killing us?
Is this a test?
Don't you know? Don't you know who this guy is? Yes. Yeah, and he says, you go because you will tell him how much, you will show him how much he will suffer for my name. Mm. And it's very interesting. So anyway, but we call it forming Ananias. And the goal is, because in our culture, most people will not make this journey on their own. I'm not saying it's impossible, but it's very difficult.
Yeah.
And most of us we were intended to do this in community, not by ourselves. And so we need many Christians who can walk with somebody, understand sort of this basic sort of process that most people in our culture go through now. We just don't process religious issues and questions the way people used to.
Right. Yeah.
The culture's so different and we're starting so far back. And so we need lots of Ananiases to kind of walk with us. And so we're presuming, you know, that we are friends walking with these people and kind of helping them. We have some idea of where they've been and what God is doing in their life now. And we can help them and say, you know, you told me that story about that conversation you had that was so important. You told me that book you read. You told me about that movie. You told me about that mystical experience you had over here.
Mm.
Sounds to me like God's talking to you, you know?
Well, the interesting thing as well is that we have to be able and humble enough to admit when we don't have the answers either. There's so many times in conversation where people think just because I've been in ministry or involved with the church for so long that I'm the person to ask about things. And so often I've found that people reacted very positively when I was humble enough to say, you know what, I don't know. Let's have a look at this together.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see what it means. Let's see what the answer is and what that means for us.
The together part was really important there, because one of the mistakes that I've made and I've seen other people make a lot is that they want to answer the questions by throwing, and I talked about leaflets before, but the most common one is books. Like I've got a friend who's got this issue. It's not something I'm interested in, but I'll give them this book. And I always say to them, don't give someone else a book. Read the book yourself and then talk to them. Mm-hmm. And have an actual conversation.
We have this, I run a very large international forum, Facebook forum, Forming Intentional Disciples Facebook forum. We have over 10,000 members from all over the world. And it's like, how many times have we said, somebody said, anybody have a book about X? You know, and everybody has, so there's like, you know, 40 people immediately have all the recommendations of all the books that you give them. But in our culture, most people don't read anymore. Yeah. They're not going to read books unless they're already highly motivated, but they do. What is really important, especially to younger adults, is relationship. Friendship is really crucial.
Yeah, it's interesting. There was just something recently released in the States that showed that the sales of physical books have gone up recently, mostly around the fact that the book club idea has come back. So it's not just about physically reading anymore. It's about that forms a basis of people just are so disconnected because of their families and everything else is broken down. They're looking for ways to connect and they're talking around things like this. So coming back to the five thresholds, we have trust, curiosity, openness, seeking, and then comes?
Intentional discipleship, conscious. Okay. And all that means is, you can't be an unconscious disciple. You can't, you know.
You got to mean it.
Yeah. Well, you have to, you choose this. Mm. It's, you know, it's not like, you know, I can wake up one morning, discover I've become a brain surgeon in my sleep. You know, I slept my way into it. This doesn't happen.
Or I've
happen.
Accidentally had a relationship with Jesus.
Yeah. Like, I mean,
Whoops.
Doesn't work like that. You and I mean, God is already reaching out to us, but we have to somehow engage deliberately in that and say yes to it.
Hmm. And that means the people bringing us to that point have to have that relationship themselves.
Yes. It's you can only help someone move as far as you yourself have gone.
And isn't that, I mean, we should have probably discussed this at the start of the podcast, but isn't that the point of the whole thing? Why, if we're not just a club attempting to get more members to justify ourselves, but there's a point that this relationship is the central element of everything that makes life make sense. It gives all the joy and the wonder that we talk about.
And it's also, it's central to our earthly happiness and our eternal happiness. I mean, I at every Called and Gifted we teach, I always quote John Henry Newman, You know, God has intended that I should reach that which will be my greatest happiness. He looks on me individually. He calls me by my name.
Yeah.
He knows what I can do, what I can best be, what is my greatest happiness. And he means to give it to me.
So lots of people see God as the big no man. You don't do this, don't do that. But actually Christ says, I've come that you have life and life to the full.
Yeah.
And the flourishing, the fullness of flourishing. And the peace they talk about in the Old Testament is a peace which is not just nobody shooting at me, but it's my whole flourishing, all of the things that can possibly go well.
And in the Catholic tradition, what makes me happy is really the first moral question. Because that's the end for which we were created. We believe that. And that's why, and that coming to walk with God, with Jesus in the midst of his church, you know, is the way through which most of us will that journey is how we will discover and reach our ultimate happiness.
Now, perhaps if I can push this a little, as we're listening to people's stories, often we find out that little pieces of that are already present in their lives. And sometimes it's not bringing them to something so much as giving them awareness of what's already there.
Well, yeah. And of course, I mean, because God is already present in their lives in some way. Yeah. And many have been cooperating, though they didn't have language for it. They wouldn't have called it Christian.
Yeah.
Maybe they said, I'm spiritual, I'm not religious. Maybe they have other language for it. But they've already sort of begun a journey. It's interesting when you run into people who've begun a journey they don't have language for yet,
or
they're not quite ready to name because it's too intimidating to name, but they know something's happening.
And sometimes they're scared to raise a particular word or a particular label because they think that you're going to take it down a track that they don't mean. They might have a word that helps them describe it. Often people have two different ideas of evangelization. One they call friendship evangelization, which seems to be what we've been describing up until, or at least something to do with friendship is a predominant part of that. And the other part is they say they have programs. So they have this program or that program.
The church actually talks about sort of three parts or stages of evangelization. And the first is what they call pre-evangelism, which is like, it's like a garden. You're preparing the soil so you can cast the seeds in there and it'll grow. And because so many people are starting so far back in our cultures, the pre-evangelization is crucial. Most of the majority of people, probably in Australia, are going to be what we would call far evangelism. They're not going to just wander in through our doors, you know, casually, because there's no bridge of trust there. They're not going to do that. We're going to have to go out to them and start walking with them, build those relationships of friendship and trust, and, you know, so that we can walk with them. And so that's, you know, really crucial. I'm sorry, I've lost track of your question.
No, it was about some people set a program a kind of a structure against the idea of friendship evangelization, but yours seems to build them into each other.
Well, the tools are, listen, I'm a professional tool creator. Tools are cool things, right?
Yes, they work.
But you need a craftsman who has a blueprint, who knows what they're trying to build and how to use a particular tool. Tools are just tools.
Yeah.
And their fruitfulness depends on how they fit the situation and the needs of the person in front of them. Mm-hmm. And in one situation, I want a hammer. In another situation, I want a saw. You know, there's no silver bullet. There's no single program that will magically make this all happen. And I can't tell you how many conversations I've had over the years with people who want us to produce a magical program, a silver bullet that will just instantly take care of all
of our problems.
Have they
tried to film you yet and do an alpha program or something like that?
Well, it's interesting because sometimes people are using the programs not because they care about where somebody is in their relationship with God, but because it's really about sustaining the institution.
Right, so they want numbers to keep the thing
numbers,
ticking over.
Numbers, we want bums in the pew, we want money, we want worker bees who will keep everything humming.
But that's not the end game
for
Christianity.
That's not the end game.
And this is part of the problem, I think, that we forget what we're actually about. Now, Christ has a very clear blueprint on how to attract people to Christ himself, and that is, he says, by this will everyone know that you are my disciples, that you love one another. Now, that isn't love them. Like, we can't put on this fake love for other people and attract them. If they see the way we treat other Christians and how we have community, if they can see that that it's real love and not just we're getting on okay, it's like a club. And the reason that shines is that Christian love's different to regular love. It's not like the Lions Club or the cricket club, and they were great things to be part of, but Christian love loves when it hurts, when it's not convenient, when the person isn't lovable in the worldly sense. Mm-hmm. And if they see that, they go, hey, this is different.
And a community where that is lived out. I mean, individuals, it's powerful to know individuals. It's even more powerful to see it lived out in a community. You know, that makes a huge difference. And people pay attention to that. Even unbelievers with no religious background notice that.
Yeah. Right.
And so really pre-evangelization is building the bridges of trust, rousing early curiosity, helping people maybe move into openness. And the second step the church talks about is proclaiming Jesus, the initial proclaiming of what he has done for us through becoming human incarnate, through his earthly life, through his teachings, his miracles, his suffering, his death, his resurrection, his ascension.
Sure.
That whole drama that is the very core of our faith and everything else the church believes in at our worship, that's because we want to foster that curiosity about Jesus. Yeah. Ultimately, in the end, they're responding to his call.
Yeah. Interesting, though, you're basically saying there that their story is coming into contact with his story.
Exactly. Yeah. Yes. Yeah.
So that was the two stages, and you had one more.
And then the last one is catechesis, initiatory catechesis, that's what the church says. But it's supposed to happen near the end of the process, not at the beginning.
Right.
What we have in practice in most of our parishes, most of our energy goes into catechesis, which is, it's kind of like we keep trying to teach university-level physics to preschoolers, okay? And we wonder why they're bored to tears.
It's not an attractive way to get
You know, but we tend to, because often those of us who are insiders and we've read all these books and we think this is all so fascinating and we want to talk about that, but spiritually they're back. They're not even in first grade yet.
So my son will read a manual of his favorite toy, read the entire instructions, but it's only because he's already passionate about the thing itself.
Well, I mean, I really like these five thresholds. It reflects more my journey. I went to a Catholic high school and I got the catechesis. I got all that stuff, but it just didn't click. I remember I was challenged by someone who's now Archbishop Porteous. one thing that in a conversation we had, and I remember going home thinking, wait, does my yes mean yes? And I remember after about a week of really questioning myself, sitting against my bedroom door and saying, okay, God, if you are there, if you do exist, take me, show me, and lead me, and I am yours. And that was, for me, a very pronounced, very singular moment.
Absolutely.
That after that, it went from being a reactive faith on my account to a proactive. I went and sought that living discipleship and went and sought those relationships with others that would help better all of us, I guess. And so this five thresholds, I think, really reflect that journey. And knowing as well that it's not just a set and done thing, I seem to be going to each one of those five constantly.
Absolutely. And we don't, what's interesting is it's not like, you know, well, I'm in curiosity so I can dump trust, you know, I'm done with that. Doesn't work like that at all. Yeah. And most of what's interesting, as God calls us to certain things, new obediences, new callings emerge in our life, we may often find ourselves retracing the whole journey.
Yeah.
I was already a disciple when, as an undergrad, I crossed the threshold of a Catholic church in Seattle near my campus and felt the real presence,
right.
Even though I didn't believe in it, didn't have language for it.
That's interesting.
And so I had to go through those thresholds on my way into the Catholic church regarding Catholicism, because I was raised anti-Catholic. So I had, did I trust? What was my bridge of trust? That mystical experience.
Yep.
But then curiosity, openness. I can tell you, in retrospect, I know exactly where I declared myself open, though I had no idea what I was doing at the time.
Right.
You know, so we may often retrace our steps deeper and deeper, deeper new obedience, as God calls us to, and we say, wait a second, that wasn't in my contract. I know the fine print. I wrote the fine print. Yeah. You know, this was not there, and you didn't tell me about it. Now I have to decide, am I going to trust you here?
Can I pick you up on that? We need to wrap up soon, but I want to pick you up on that one, that when I became a Catholic, I referred to myself as a convert, and I remember feeling a bit uneasy about that, and lots of other people talk to me about they refer to me as being a convert. And I don't think I converted to a new religion when I became Catholic. I refer to it as a completion of a faith which began, if you like, it was very much nurtured. I didn't change faith from the Bible that I read. I didn't get a new Bible. I didn't get a new Jesus. You know, all of those things were completed and rounded off, if you like, in the Catholic Church. And it's still something that's the ongoing process of discipleship is a completion, a constantly building up of that faith. And it occurs to me as I was reading your book for the first time, this is actually probably true not just of people who are openly Christian, but there's already goodness which we're talking about. Their journey has already begun. We shouldn't pretend it's beginning with this conversation, that we're kind of just stepping on the train at one of the stops and we'll get off at another stop and they'll keep going too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's why it's so important we let them tell us where they've been and where they're going, and where they've seen the hand of God or not.
And that we aren't the driver.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes. All right. That's an excellent place to wrap it up. Now it's time for a section we call 1 Minute Wonder. So this is something where we share something that we've seen, heard, or experienced this week that's made us stop and wonder about something that made us smile or appreciate God and our life a little more. Box.
I've been working this week a lot on my commissions and just reflecting as an artist, I guess, the concept of creating. And I don't believe that I create from nothing. I create from things around me. Just this concept of partnership, I guess. You know, God's the creator, and here I am manipulating what's there to also reflect that creativeness. It's something that I know my cousins, my young cousins who are in primary school and high school, have shown real interest in what I do. And it's sort of become that reflection of, I guess, I show my faith in that way as I create. And it's just amazing that we have this capacity to, I guess, co-create in that sense, something that hopefully reflects beauty or God.
But it kind of comes out of you too.
Yeah, in the whole process, yeah.
Have you got a 1 minute wonder for us?
Well, I've been in Australia less than a week, so my wonder is that I'm living in the future as far as the United States is concerned. And every time I think about home, or this morning I was looking at the Liturgy of the Hours, and, you know, it was Wednesday here, and then it hit me like just out of the blue that it's only Thursday afternoon at home.
Tuesday, in fact.
Tuesday afternoon. Yeah. I'm sorry, it's Tuesday afternoon at home, and I'm just like, oh, that is so weird.
My 1 minute wonder is my little boy is actually just come home from hospital on my way here, actually. He was in hospital overnight after an operation, very minor operation, but all of our children were staying with friends because I wasn't able to look after them while I was at work. And it meant that last night it was just myself and my three oldest children. And that meant we had some very adult conversations, and we watched an adult movie together, and we had a lot of fun just being adults. And it struck me that they're three really interesting people to hang around with. They're awesome individuals and adults in their own right. It was good fun. So there you go. That's it for this week's podcast. If today's discussion got you thinking or arguing with your podcast device, let us know. You can subscribe to the podcast on thiscatholiclife.com.au, or you can tell us what you liked by emailing us at info@thiscatholiclife.com.au. You can join the conversation on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, or Discord, and you can find all of those on the show notes on our website. Be sure to write us a review on iTunes so that more people can find us. Remember that this is a uniquely Australian podcast, and we think that that's an idea worth getting behind. So tell your friends about it. Before we go, it's time for a quick shout out. Box?
Just, I guess, the homeless at the moment, those who are less well off as we are. It's been really weird weather in Australia, and just from my own history with the poor,
right,
I know how tough it is. So just shout out to them, and really I pray that they have that nourishment and safety that we need.
Good call. I'm going to shout out to my boy, Albert, who's just back from an operation, and I missed him. So,
hello out there in America, anybody who happens to be listening.
From the future.
Yes, from the future.
That's all for now, and thank you for listening to This Catholic Life.